Well, friends, we come today to a new series of sermons to be preached here at All Souls in the mornings based on the prophet Habakkuk. So I invite you now to turn to Habakkuk. And if you're not too sure where you'll find it, it's in the Old Testament between those other well-known prophets, Nahum and Zephaniah. And if that doesn't help you, turn to page 940. Now don't worry if you find it hard to find Habakkuk in your Bibles, or even if you've never heard of him. John Chapman, the evangelist, once told a clergy gathering of a recurring nightmare he had where he was asked to read the lesson in St Andrew's Cathedral, Sydney. And as he came up to the lectern in front of 1,000-strong congregations of bishops, archbishops and other assorted dignitaries, he discovered to his horror that the lesson was from the prophet Habakkuk. And then he discovered, secondly, he was further horrified to find that the lectern Bible had the contents page torn out. So if you didn't find it straight away, you're in good company. Now, if the first challenge is to find the prophet, the second challenge is to know how to pronounce his name. The rector suggested I should pronounce it Habakkuk, as in, have a cooked breakfast. In America, I think it's pronounced Habakkuk, but I was brought up with Habakkuk, so I'll leave it up to you to decide. Well, our plan now is to go through the passage and see what we can discover about Habakkuk and his message. So first one, I've entitled, The Prophet is Introduced, verse 1 of Habakkuk 1. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet received. Now basically what we see written in that verse is all that we know about this man Habakkuk. He's mentioned nowhere else in the Bible and less is stated of him than of any other prophet. He's simply described as the prophet. That is, one called by God to tell forth God's words to God's people. Nothing is said about where he came from, how old he was, or when he spoke. He's simply called the prophet. Now some scholars think that somehow he might have been a prophet associated with the temple of Jerusalem. And the reason they say that is for the very last verse of Habakkuk in chapter 3 has these words. For the director of music on my stringed instruments. Now those words are not a message to Noel Treddinick about today's music, but they tell us that at some stage the prophet's words were set to music. And this may mean that Habakkuk was a temple prophet. He spent his days teaching God's people in Jerusalem about God's ways. Now the second thing we note in this opening verse, which introduces the prophet, is that the word translated oracle can equally be translated burden. So we may read verse 1 as the burden that Habakkuk the prophet received. So here we have a man to whom God has spoken. He has received a message from God. And this message to Habakkuk was no light thing. It wasn't something he could hear one day and forget about when he went home. God's message, he says, is a burden upon him. He's carrying it as of a weight. Now, our desire as a preaching team is that as we study Habakkuk over these next 6 weeks, that we might share something of Habakkuk's burden. A burden for the people of God, that they may be faithful, that we may be faithful to God, and a burden for our world. For this seems to me to be the burden that Habakkuk was bearing. So first of all, the prophet introduced, verse 1. Secondly, the prophet's cry for help, verses 2 to 4. Look at them there. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you don't listen? or I cry out to you violence, but you do not save. Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. Now it was in 1996 that one of Australia's worst atrocities occurred when a man called Martin Bryant took a gun and went to a tourist place in Tasmania called Port Arthur, and he began to indiscriminately shoot at people for seemingly no reason. Within a space of 2 hours, he'd killed 35 people and wounded another 20. And his actions stunned the nation. And there are still ramifications of it in terms of discussions about the need for gun reform in the law. Now, within all that was said and written about this incident since, the article that has most affected me was one written by a newspaper journalist, and the article was simply called Why? Let me read a portion of it for you. It was too much to expect, but the expectation was there, and it was insistent, haunting and undeniable. It's an expectation that is always there when human beings are confronted with evil, with actions by a fellow human that are inhuman, obscure, life-denying. What we want from those who do those terrible things, what we expect from them, is an explanation, an answer to the question why. If we get the answer, then those who died and who suffered, what happened to them will not have been entirely senseless, random, simply and terribly the result of them being in the wrong place at the wrong time. For the survivors and for the rest of us, that is what would be unbearable. The idea that what was done without reason or sense of explanation. That such evil as was done was in a sense just a random act of nature. Now this journalist puts into words that most basic of human cries that confront us when unjust suffering occurs. Whether it's an indiscriminate killing or a blood transfusion patient who innocently gets AIDS and subsequently dies, there is always that question that cries out to be answered, why? Now this, in effect, is what Habakkuk is doing here in these verses. His people are suffering and he is crying out, why, God? Now, as I said before, it's uncertain when this book was written, but it's likely to have been at the end of the 7th century BC. The nation of Judah had enjoyed many good years under King Josiah. He was a law-abiding king. But Josiah had been tragically killed, and his son took over, Jehoiakim. And the best that could be said about Jehoiakim is the 9-word epitaph that we read about in 2 Kings. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. And this is what God is crying out to, this is what Habakkuk is crying out to God about. God, our nation is sliding into apostasy under this godless king, and you don't seem to care. Look at those verses 2-4 again as we pick up 3 reasons why Habakkuk is crying out to God. First of all, verses 3-4, wrongs are going unpunished. He speaks there of injustice, wrongs, destruction, violence all around him. Strife and conflicts are abounding. The law, which is meant to say that evil people will be punished by God, seem to go unpunished. Justice is never prevailing. And the wicked surround the righteous when the righteous speak up for God.
and they're not allowed to speak, and justice is perverted. Wrongs, says Habakkuk, these wrongs in our nation are going unpunished. Lord, why won't you do something about it? Wrongs are going unpunished. Secondly, sufferers are going unrescued. Verse 2, the second half of verse 2. I cry out to you, Lord, violence, but you do not save. Lord, your righteous people, the remnant people, who are seeking to obey your law, are going unsaved. They're being trampled on by the evil. Have you given up on us, Lord? And thirdly, prayers are going unanswered. The very first line of verse 2. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Now it seems to me Habakkuk's experience is so often our experience. We cry out to God, but he just does not seem to hear. This is why the Psalms are so powerful to many people, for they relate to us these sorts of human experiences. Psalm 22, O my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer. I cry by night, but I find no rest. Psalm 44, Awake, O Lord, why do you sleep? Rouse yourself, do not reject us forever. Now the question that suffering often brings to us is not so much, is there a God? That might be the question it raises to the non-Christian, but to the Christian we don't say, is there a God? But we usually say, why God? Why? What is happening? Give me some idea as to what is happening to me in this situation, or to my child, or to my nation. Let me know and then I'll be satisfied, then I'll trust in you. But so often God seems to be silent. And this is Habakkuk's problem. But note what Habakkuk does about his concerns. He doesn't hide them from God, as though a good Christian shouldn't talk to God about that sort of stuff. He doesn't think that God wouldn't be bothered by them. He doesn't pretend that these deep issues do not exist. But he cries out to God about them. He complains to God about them. He keeps on praying. He knows that God is a covenant God. He says in verse 2, How long, O Lord? He uses the covenant name for God. The God who in the past has made promises to his people, and he's trusting that he will continue to keep his promises to his people, and that's the reason why he cries out. Prayer, ultimately, is a matter of trusting a trustworthy God. Trusting in a God who, in spite of external circumstances, which so often seem to point to the contrary, this God is ultimately trustworthy and will carry us through. John Calvin says this in his commentary on these verses. Calvin says, Nothing wrong ought to be ascribed to our prayers when we freely pour forth our feelings. For God does not condemn this freedom in our prayers, but on the contrary, the end of praying is this, that each one of us, as we pour forth, as it's said in the Psalms, our hearts before God, will be heard by a God who can be trusted. So the prophets cry for help. Thirdly, verses 5 to 11, the prophet's surprising message. Look at verse 5 as God finally answers Habakkuk's complaint. Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians. Here we see God's answer to Habakkuk's cry for help. He says in effect, Habakkuk, I've heard your cry and I'm going to answer your prayer. This is the message I want you to tell the people. Tell them to lift up their eyes and look at the nations at the horizon, and they will be amazed, for they will see the Babylonians coming. Now, there are two reasons why this is a surprising message. First reason is this. The Babylonians at that stage were not the superpower that they would later come to be. They were as if I was to tell you that New Zealand would one day become a world power. Now, I know that for any Kiwis here, that will not surprise you. You know that will be the case. But for many of us, it might be a surprise. So the first reason, the Babylonians weren't the superpower as they might have expected. The second reason that it's so surprising is that God is going to raise up, he says, people to judge the people of Judah who will prove to be much worse than the wicked people Habakkuk was complaining about in the first place. Look at that incredibly long catalogue in verses 5 to 11, the catalogue of what these people are going to do to judge the people of Judah. Verse 6, they're called a ruthless and impetuous people. They'll sweep across the earth to Judah, to the people of Jerusalem, and seize dwelling places not their own. Nothing's going to stop them. Verse 7, they're described as a feared and dreaded people. They're a law unto themselves. Someone has said their power was in their law, that their power was their law, their sword was their tribunal. Verse 8, their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong, their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping to devour. That is just like the bird of prey. The vulture spots its prey from afar and then swoops down to grab it. So the Babylonians will come upon God's people in judgment. Verse 9, they come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind. They gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at the fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. That is, Judah has no escape. Prisoners will be taken. Any alliances with foreign kings or princes will be to no avail. The Babylonians will capture their cities in their own way. And finally, verse 11. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own strength is their God. Now, this is what is surprising. God is saying here he's planning to raise up a nation that is opposed to him as God. He's going to use an evil people to judge his own evil people. Habakkuk, you've complained about this bad situation, and God says, in effect, I'm going to make it even worse. Now, all of this raises the age-old problem of evil and suffering. Is it possible for God to do such a thing, to be the author of even evil things? Is he the cause of not only the good things that happen in the world, but also the bad things that happen? Now, over the next few weeks, we'll see how Habakkuk comes to resolve those issues and how he comes to trust in God in spite of the adversities that he has been told will soon be affecting his nation. So let me say at this point, watch this space. But underlying that problem of evil that he raises is an even deeper issue that Habakkuk is speaking about. Look there at verse 6. God says, I am raising up the Babylonians. What in essence God is saying here to Habakkuk is this. I am the one behind human history. The rise and fall of nations is in my hands. Those Babylonians may think it was them that is rising up in strength to conquer the known world at the time. But God is saying, it's me who is doing it. I will raise up this people. The great preacher C.H. Spurgeon once preached a sermon called God's Providences, and in it he said this. Napoleon once heard it said that man proposes and God disposes. And Napoleon replied, but I can propose and dispose too. How do you think, says Spurgeon, he proposed and disposed? He proposed to go and take Russia. He proposed to make all of Europe his. He proposed to destroy Russia. And how did he come back again? How had he disposed of it? He came back solitary and alone. His mighty army was perished and wasted, having well nigh eaten and devoured one another through hunger. Man proposes, but God disposes. The great truth we see in these verses, this early chapter of Habakkuk, is this. We have a sovereign God. A God who is in control even of the nations of the world. Habakkuk is telling us that all that has happened in the past 12 months, 12 years, the past 12 centuries, the whole history of the world, all of this is not an arbitrary thing. It is not the result of chance. It is not because of a nation's military might. But God is behind it all. He is the one that causes nations to rise and fall. As God says through Isaiah, the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. God weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Now friends, this doctrine of the sovereignty of God in our world is a comforting doctrine. We know that God is in control of things. No matter what will face us in the future, we're told, God is in control. Today is the day in Europe when a major event will occur across the English Channel. There'll be a convergence of all the major EU members' currencies into a single currency. Now, some people heralded that as great. It'll see the resurgence of Europe. Others have prophesied disaster. Nations will collapse. Millions will have their livelihoods threatened. But what does Habakkuk say about these events? He says, God is in control of them. Man proposes, but God disposes. The prophet introduced, the prophet's cry for help, and thirdly, the prophet's surprising message. Well, friends, let's conclude. And I want to conclude by asking you to turn to another passage. Page 1108, 1108, turn to the New Testament, to Acts chapter 13, verse 41. Here we see in this passage Paul using these very verses that we've been talking about in his very first sermon on his first missionary journey. He quotes from Habakkuk chapter 1. He's preaching to the Jews in modern-day Turkey, and he concludes his sermon with these words. Look at verses 38 and 39. Therefore, my brothers, I want you to know that through Jesus, the forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you. Through him, everyone who believes is justified from everything you could not be justified from by the law of Moses. Here Paul is offering to these people the great salvation that he discovered that comes through Jesus Christ. He says, you can know forgiveness and justification through Christ, he tells these people. And then he offers them the warning, verse 40 and 41. Take care then that what the prophets have said, what he's saying is what Habakkuk has said, does not happen to you. Look, you scoffers, wonder and perish, for I am going to do something in your days that you wouldn't believe, even if someone told you. What Paul is saying, in effect, is this. Just as then, so even now. Just as God's judgment came to his people back then when they failed to listen to the message of Habakkuk that God was going to raise up a ruthless nation, the Babylonians, to destroy them, just as they failed to listen to it, in the same way, make sure that you don't fall into that trap. God's judgment, he says, will come to all those who reject this message that I am giving, says Paul, this message of God's forgiveness and justification. And I take it that when Paul speaks of the judgment, he's referring to God's final judgment. And if that's the case, then all of us who are in this church today are in the same position as those hearers of Paul in Acts 13. You see, here we see the essence of the message of Habakkuk in chapter 1 as addressed by Paul in Acts 13. And his message is simply this. We have a God who is in control. Although we humans think we know what is going on in the world, behind the scenes, a sovereign God is at work. He was at work in Habakkuk's day, raising up the Babylonians to judge his people, and that finally happened in the year 587 BC. He was at work some 80 years after that, when the Babylonians were themselves brought under God's judgment at the hands of another superpower, the Persians. They were judged by God, as we read in Habakkuk 1 verse 11, for that they were guilty men whose own strength was their God. And Paul says to us, and the scriptures say to us, and one day we will see him at work again. On that day, as we read in the Creed, when he will come again to judge the living and the dead. The message of Habakkuk today for us is this. We have a God who is in control. Let us today be people confident in his sovereign power, secure in him through his offer of salvation through Christ. May we today be ready to meet him on that day when all the world will see his power and might, the day of his return. Amen.